Welcome to The Deep Dive, the show that extracts the most important nuggets of knowledge and insight from the sources you share with us. Today, we're embarking on a very special deep dive, the Federal Register for Tuesday, August 19th, 2025. I'm Alex Smith, and I'll be your guide through these pages.
And I'm Taylor Johnson, here to help connect the dots and explore the broader implications of everything we uncover today.
So our mission is, a pretty comprehensive look at this daily publication. For anyone maybe not familiar, the Federal Register isn't just some government newsletter.
No, not at all. It's the official journal of the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm.
Think of it as the place where all federal agency regulations, legal notices, presidential actions, everything that has legal effect gets published.
Exactly. Presidential proclamations, executive orders, big agency rules, even smaller notices of public interest. It's the ultimate record. It can be dense, definitely, but incredibly powerful once you understand what's in there.
It really is. And it's not just paper pushing. This is fundamental to government transparency. I mean, the contents are actually judicially noticed, 44 U.S. Code 1507. That means courts have to accept what's printed in the register as fact.
Wow.
Yeah. And it comes out every weekday. You can still get it on paper or microfiche, believe it or not.
Really? Microfiche?
Yep. But the best part, it's totally free online at govinfo.gov. Updated every publishing day by 6 a.m. Eastern. Plus, if you're into history, the online archive goes all the way back to 1936.
March 14th, 1936, to be exact. So when we talk about official government information, this really is the source.
The definitive source, absolutely.
Okay, so our goal today is to cut through all that legalese, you know, the dense reports. We want to bring you the key insights from just this one day's publication and show how these documents, which might seem dry, actually shape the world around you.
Touching everything from, say, your healthcare and how you travel to the infrastructure that powers the country. It's all in there.
Think of it as your shortcut to being really well-informed. We'll try to make it engaging, maybe even find a little humor in the bureaucracy. Let's dive in.
Presidential directives, shaping national agendas.
All right, first up in the presidential documents section, we've got a pretty significant one, Executive Order 14336. The title is Fortifying America's Pharmaceutical Supply Chain. Now, this was signed just a few days back, August 13th, 2025. And it's not entirely new, right? It builds on some previous efforts.
That's right. It's building on work to boost domestic production of essential medicines. The core problem it's trying to tackle, really, is our reliance on foreign sources for critical pharmaceutical ingredients.
Which we saw become a major issue recently.
Exactly. So the main goal here is to enhance the resilience of our pharmaceutical supply chain. And it does that by specifically aiming to fill something called the Strategic Active Pharmaceutical Ingredients Reserve. Think of it like a national emergency stockpile, but for the raw ingredients needed to make essential drugs.
So not just finished pills, but the core components.
Precisely. It's a direct follow-on from an earlier executive order, 13944, from back in August 2020. That one was really focused on fighting public health emergencies by buying more domestically produced drugs and identifying where our supply chain weaknesses were for essential medicines and critical inputs.
Okay, so this is about making sure we're not vulnerable if, say, global shipping gets disrupted or there's another crisis. I remember the FDA put out a big list of essential medicines initially.
They did back in October 2020, but then ASPR, that's the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, they refined that list down to about 86 essential medicines, a more focused target list.
Right. So how does this new order specifically aim to fill the reserve? What does that actually mean in practice? Are we talking about the government buying up huge amounts of these ingredients?
Well, it mandates action. It directs the relevant agencies to take concrete steps to increase that strategic reserve. The idea is to ensure we have a stable, reliable domestic supply of these vital ingredients.
So it's proactive,
yeah.
Trying to prevent the kinds of shortages we've seen before.
Exactly. Preventing shortages during future emergencies. It's a direct hit on improving public health security. And it's interesting, the order notes that HHS Health and Human Services will pay for the publication of this order in the Federal Register. That kind of signals their central role and the financial commitment involved.
Yeah. So for you listening, the bottom line here is pretty clear. This directly affects the availability and maybe even the cost of life-saving medications when we face another public health crisis. It's the government actively trying to avoid those supply chain nightmares we experienced, securing medicine access for everyone. Okay, shifting gears from potential future crises to a program that's been a safety net for decades. Also, in today's register, there's a presidential proclamation, and this one marks a really major anniversary.
A huge one.
It celebrates 90 years since President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act, August 14th, 1935. 90 years. That's incredible longevity for any piece of legislation.
It really is monumental. The Social Security Act fundamentally changed American society. Its impact, historically and socially, is just immense. It created a system that protects seniors, provides a basic economic floor for many citizens, and supports the livelihoods of Americans who worked and contributed.
It offered a level of security that just didn't exist for most people before then.
Absolutely. It's touched almost every family in some way.
And the proclamation makes it clear the current administration sees it as vital today. It talks about a strong recommitment to always defending Social Security, rewarding workers, taking care of family, seniors. It's not just looking back, it's a statement about present policy.
Yes, it's a very strong reaffirmation. And think about it, despite all the political debates over the years, the fact that Social Security is still here after 90 years really speaks volumes about its fundamental role. It's like this bipartisan anchor of economic stability.
A rare constant.
A very rare constant. So for you, the listener, this is a reminder that this program, this safety net, is still there for current retirees, for people nearing retirement, and the plan is for it to be there for future generations too. It really underscores its enduring importance. Two, rules and regulations, concrete changes in policy.
Okay, we've seen the big picture directives from the president. Now let's get into the rules and regulations section. This is where policy gets concrete. And first up, we have kind of a reversal from the Department of Transportation, the DOT.
Ah, yes, the hotline.
They're formally terminating their plan to set up an aviation consumer hotline. Now, on the surface, that might sound like, well, less help for travelers, maybe a step back. What's really going on?
Well, the backstory is key here. This isn't really the DOT deciding on its own to scrap the idea. The original plan for this hotline came from Congress. It was mandated in the FAA Reauthorization Act of 2018. They had to create a toll-free hotline and make airlines display the number everywhere.
Okay, so it was required by law.
It was. But then Congress changed its mind. In the next FAA Reauthorization Act, the one in 2024, Section 520 specifically eliminated that requirement for the DOT to create the hotline.
Ah, so the legal mandate just disappeared.
Exactly. The requirement was removed by Congress, so the DOT is now formally terminating the rulemaking process because the underlying reason for it no longer exists. The rule is now unnecessary.
Got it. So it's not DOT reducing consumer protection, it's them following the latest law. The Register says the termination is consistent with the administration's focus on reducing regulation. How does this fit into maybe broader trends, and what does it mean practically for you if you're flying? No new hotline.
Right. It clearly reflects that broader push towards deregulation where legislative support has been withdrawn. For you, the traveler, it means that this specific federally mandated hotline, the one that was supposed to be prominently displayed, well, it's not happening.
But other ways to complain still exist.
Oh, yes. You can still file complaints with the DOT through their existing channels, or directly with the airlines, of course. Those avenues aren't changing. But this particular new easy access hotline won't be coming online. It's a really clear example of how a change in law directly impacts regulations and the services you might expect.
Okay, moving on. This next one gets into the weeds a bit, but it shows how regulations adapt. The IRS and Treasury are amending rules for enrolled actuaries, specifically about their continuing professional education, or CPE. What's the big change here?
The big change is removing the physical presence requirement for what counts as a formal CPE program for active enrolled actuaries, meaning they no longer have to physically attend a course or seminar in person for it to count towards their required education hours. Educational programs delivered entirely electronically online now fully qualify.
That sounds like a huge shift towards flexibility. Was this maybe influenced by the pandemic experience?
Absolutely. The text explicitly says the change was made after considering feedback, and importantly, taking into account the successful operation of the continuing professional education programs that were conducted during the COVID-19 pandemic without a physical presence requirement.
So basically, remote learning worked fine, maybe even well for them during that time, and now they're making it official policy.
Precisely. It proved the viability and the benefits of electronic delivery. So it's an agency adapting based on real-world experience and embedding that lesson into the regulations long term.
They even included examples. Can you maybe walk us through one? Like, how does this help an actuary who might have fallen behind on credits?
Sure. Let's take their example three. Imagine actuary GG didn't quite meet the required core hours. By the deadline, they had enough total hours, just not enough core ones. So they become inactive for a short period. Under the old rules, getting back to active status might have meant finding and physically attending specific core courses quickly. Now, with this change, G could just complete the needed 6 core hours online, maybe even the day after the deadline. They filed their application, showing they now meet all the requirements, including those hours earned right after the cycle ended. The joint board can then grant the application, and G returns to active status, maybe only being inactive for a couple of weeks.
Much more efficient.
Much more efficient and flexible. It allows them to maintain their credentials more easily without the logistical hassle of required physical attendance.
So the takeaway for you listening, even if enrolled actuary CPE isn't your daily world, is this. It's a small example of a bigger trend. Government agencies are adapting rules to fit modern technology and lessons learned, like from the pandemic. It makes professional development more accessible, which ultimately impacts how expertise is maintained across many fields. Okay, next up, robocalls. Something pretty much everyone deals with. The FCC has adopted new third-party authentication guardrails. This is part of their 8th report and order. What exactly are these guardrails, and why do we need them?
Right. These guardrails are essentially new rules aimed at strengthening the fight against illegal robocalls. They involve things like specific record-keeping requirements and making sure providers are certified in the robocall mitigation database.
The goal being.
The fundamental goal is to boost the integrity and trustworthiness of the STIR/SHAKEN framework. That's the technology ecosystem designed to verify caller ID information.
So making it harder for scammers to fake the number that shows up on your phone.
Exactly. It's about ensuring that when your phone rings, you have a better chance of trusting that the displayed number is legitimate. These rules have a compliance deadline tied to their publication here in the Register and OMB approval, generally giving providers several months to implement.
Now, what I found fascinating here, the FCC actually puts numbers on the public safety benefits of cutting down robocalls. It's not just about annoyance. Can you break that down? It's pretty powerful stuff.
It really is striking. They reference earlier findings suggesting that even small delays in emergency response times, potentially caused by robocalls flooding lines or sowing confusion, could have devastating consequences. They estimate a 1-minute reduction in average response times could save nearly 14,000 lives annually.
Wow.
Yeah, valued at something like $173 billion. And even if illegal robocalls cause just a 1-second delay on average, the potential benefit of eliminating that delay is estimated at almost $3 billion annually in reduced mortality risk.
Even a fraction of a second makes a difference.
They even calculated that a tiny improvement, like 0.035 seconds, about 1/30th of a second, could yield $100 million in annual public safety benefits. It really reframes robocalls from just a nuisance to a genuine public safety issue, highlighting the hidden costs.
So, how does the FCC justify doing this? What's their authority, and how does it impact different types of phone companies?
Their authority comes mainly from the Communications Act and the Truth in Caller ID Act. These laws give the FCC power to prevent unlawful caller ID spoofing and abuse of phone numbers. The rules apply broadly to wired carriers and local resellers, and they do provide specific definitions for small businesses in those categories.
Is this considered a major rule?
Yes, it's categorized as a major rule under the Congressional Review Act, which gives Congress a window to review it. Importantly, for the industry structure, intermediate providers, those in the middle of the call path, especially non-gateway ones, can meet some obligations by working with third-party authentication services.
But there's a catch.
There's a key catch. The third party has to sign the calls using the intermediate provider's digital certificate, and crucially, the intermediate provider still has to make the final decision about the call's attestation level, basically. How trustworthy the caller ID info is. It keeps the responsibility with the provider handling the call.
So it's a direct government action trying to finally get a handle on robocalls. And as you said, the benefits go way beyond just fewer annoying calls, potentially impacting public safety in a big way. 3, proposed rules. Glimpses into future regulations. Okay, we've covered rules that are now official. Let's shift to proposed rules. This section gives us a peek at what agencies are considering for the future. First, the FDA. They've received a petition from a company called Evonik Corporation.
Right.
What are they proposing to add to animal food? And, you know, why should we as consumers maybe pay attention to this?
They're petitioning the FDA to amend the food additive regulations to allow the safe use of something called Bacillus vilisensis. It's basically a type of beneficial bacteria, a microorganism. They want it approved for use in animal food for all species.
Like a probiotic for animals?
Essentially, yes. It represents adding a new ingredient to the list of things approved for animal feed. While it might seem very specific, these changes matter.
How so? Why should you care if you're not in agriculture?
Because changes in animal feed can have ripple effects. They can impact animal health, growth rates, how efficiently animals convert feed into meat, milk, or eggs, and all that can eventually influence the food supply chain, affecting the costs, the quality, maybe even the safety profile of the food that ends up on your plate. It's a reminder that the beginning of the food chain matters.
Interesting. Okay, next proposed rule. The Food Safety and Inspection Service, FSIS. They're proposing a rule about visual post-mortem inspection in swine slaughter establishments. Sounds technical. But the key label here is deregulatory action. What's changing, and how is it supposed to save money?
Right. That deregulatory action tag, linked to a specific executive order about deregulation, is important context. The core change, and where the cost savings come from, is reducing the number of FSIS online postmortem inspectors, the federal inspectors, physically examining carcasses on the slaughter line.
Fewer federal inspectors on the line?
Fewer federal inspectors. The analysis assumes these positions, with their government salaries and benefits, would be reduced, leading to significant cost savings for the agency and potentially the industry indirectly.
So if there are fewer federal eyes directly on the line, who picks up that slack? Who's doing that inspection work? And what does that mean for food safety oversight?
That's the crucial question. The proposal relies on a system where large plants using the new swine inspection system, or NSIS, would employ their own staff, called sorters, potentially up to 11 per line. These company employees will be responsible for trimming carcasses and identifying defects like contamination or signs of disease before the remaining FSIS inspectors conduct their final postmortem check.
So more responsibility shifts to the plant's own employees.
Exactly. Industry employees take on tasks previously done by federal inspectors. From an environmental standpoint, the USDA has determined this type of action usually doesn't require a big environmental review unless there are significant effects, which they don't foresee here.
So for you, the listener, the tension here is clear. This aims for efficiency and cost reduction in pork processing, which could impact prices. But it raises questions about the level of direct federal oversight ensuring the safety of the pork you buy. It's a balancing act between deregulation and traditional inspection models. All right, let's look up. The Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, is proposing to update an existing airworthiness directive, an AD, for certain Airbus helicopter models. This is definitely about safety, right?
Absolutely. Safety is a driving force behind airworthiness directives. This proposed rule targets Airbus helicopters model AS332L2 and EC225LP. It's meant to supersede an older AD from 2020.
What was the issue with the older one?
The original AD was prompted by findings from EASA, the European Union Aviation Safety Agency. They found a problem with tightening torque loss on the fittings attachment bolts for the main gearbox suspension bars.
So critical bolts holding the main gearbox could loosen. That sounds serious.
Potentially very serious. Since that finding, the manufacturer, Airbus, developed a design improvement. This new proposed AD requires incorporating that modification into the helicopters to permanently fix the potential issue.
And the level of detail in these ADs is always impressive. It's not just tighten the bolts, is it?
Oh no, it's incredibly specific. The directive lists the exact part numbers for the bolts and fittings involved. Owners have to review aircraft maintenance records to find the total hours these specific parts have been in service. And then they have to apply a life limit add-on factor, which essentially reduces the approved lifespan of these parts as an extra safety margin. There are also requirements for physical inspections of the attachment nuts to check their torque. If any parts are removed, they must be replaced with new, airworthy ones, including specific washers, torqued to precise values like 735 to 840 pound force inches for certain nuts.
Wow.
And if a helicopter hasn't had a specific modification installed already, this AD mandates that modification, often involving installing new bracket links within a set compliance time, like a certain number of flight hours or by a specific date. Even though it's technical, the FAA notes this isn't considered a significant regulatory action under the main executive order governing regulations. It's routine safety work for them.
The insight for you listening. This proposed rule is a direct action to enhance safety for these specific helicopter types, used in demanding roles like offshore transport or rescue. It showcases the meticulous, detailed work that goes into keeping aircraft safe and the vital international cooperation, like with EASA, that underpins aviation safety globally. Okay, let's turn to taxes now. The IRS is proposing changes related to reporting sales or exchanges of certain partnership interests. Sounds like they're trying to ease a burden for partnerships.
That's exactly the goal. This proposal modifies the rules for reporting when an interest in a partnership is sold or exchanged, specifically if that partnership holds things like inventory or unrealized receivables, basically, income earned but not yet collected.
What's the specific burden they're addressing?
The main issue was a requirement for partnerships to provide certain information, the details in Part 4 of Form 8308, to the parties involved in the transaction by January 31st of the following year. Many partnerships found this deadline really difficult, an undue burden, because they often just didn't have all the necessary financial information calculated and finalized that early.
Okay, so that specific early deadline for Part 4 info is going away under the proposal. What will partnerships still need to do and when?
Right, that Jan 31 deadline for furnishing Part 4 info is proposed to be removed. Instead, partnerships would only need to furnish the info from Parts 1, 2, and 3 of Form 8308, or an equivalent statement, to the transferor and transferee. And the deadline for that would be the later of either January 31st of the following year or 30 days after the partnership gets notified about the exchange.
So potentially more time if they're notified later.
Yep. Exactly. However, and this is important, the proposal does not change the requirement for the partnership to file the fully completed Form 8308, including Part 4, as an attachment to their main partnership tax return, Form 1065, when that's due. So the final filing requirement remains, just the early notification piece is adjusted. This follows some earlier penalty relief the IRS offered, showing they've been hearing feedback on this issue.
So for you, the listener, this shows the tax system trying to adapt. It's an example of the IRS responding to feedback from businesses to reduce a specific reporting headache, potentially making compliance a bit easier for complex partnerships without removing the core reporting requirement. Let's talk air quality again. The EPA is proposing to approve Tennessee's plan to deal with regional haze. What exactly is regional haze, and what does this approval mean for places like the Great Smoky Mountains?
Regional haze is basically visibility impairment, that hazy, murky look in the air caused by air pollution. It particularly affects scenic views in national parks and wilderness areas, which are called Class I areas. Tennessee submitted this plan back in 2022 to meet its obligations under the Clean Air Act to improve visibility through the year 2028.
So the goal is clearer skies in those beautiful areas.
Precisely. The plan sets specific targets for improvement, called Uniform Rate of Progress, or URP values, focusing on the 20% most impaired or haziest days. For example, for Great Smoky Mountains and nearby Joyce Kilmer Wilderness, the target visibility level for 2028 is 21.49 DSIVUs, a measure of visibility. EPA proposing approval means they think Tennessee's plan is adequate to hit those targets.
Now, what's interesting is the plan seems to focus heavily on certain pollutants, specifically sulfur dioxide, SO2, over nitrogen oxides, NOx. Why that emphasis?
That comes down to the science and modeling Tennessee did. Their analysis, called PSAT results, showed that at their Class I areas, reducing SO2 emissions gives significantly more bang for the buck in terms of improving visibility compared to reducing NOx emissions.
So a ton of SO2 reduction clears the air more than a ton of NOx reduction.
Essentially, yes. The sulfate visibility impacts per ton are universally higher than nitrate visibility impacts per ton. Because of that, the state focused its analysis and control strategy evaluations primarily on major SO2 sources, like the Eastman Chemical Plant and the TVA Cumberland Power Plant. It's a targeted approach based on maximizing visibility improvement.
And the plan gets into specific control technologies and how much they cost versus how much pollution they remove. Can you give an example for, say, Eastman?
Sure. For one of Eastman's boilers, Boiler 30, the plan evaluated replacing an existing pollution control device, an ESP, with a fabric filter combined with an existing scrubber. This was estimated to achieve 92% SO2 control efficiency, but at a cost of around $7,834 per ton of SO2 removed.
That sounds like a lot.
It is substantial. For other boilers, installing different technology like direct sorbent injection plus fabric filters was estimated at around $8,725 per ton for a 90% control. The state compared these costs to controls implemented in previous planning periods and noted these current options were significantly more expensive. For example, that 7,834 deductions was about 72-73% higher than a previous high-cost option considered years ago. It highlights the increasing cost of squeezing out further emission reductions. The plan also considers things like smoke management for prescribed burns, another haze contributor.
So for you listening, this impacts the air you breathe and the views you see in national treasures. It shows the complex, data-heavy process of environmental regulation balancing the very real economic costs for industry against the public health benefits and the value we place on clear scenic vistas. Okay, another proposed rule from the FCC. This one's about something really fundamental: how they conduct environmental reviews for communications infrastructure, things, cell towers, fiber lines. What's prompting this fresh look at their environmental rules?
This is driven by a whole cluster of recent changes. The FCC is looking to revise its rules under the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, aiming to streamline the environmental review process. This is happening because DET itself was recently amended by Congress, the Council on Environmental Quality, CEQ, changed its NEPA regulations. There are relevant executive orders focused on speeding up permitting, like one called Unleashing American Energy, and there was also a recent Supreme Court decision that impacts how agencies consider environmental effects.
So a lot of pressure to speed things up.
A lot of pressure to speed up federal permitting and infrastructure deployment, especially for things like broadband.
This gets into core legal ideas like what constitutes a major federal action or MFA. How does the type of license the FCC issues, say, for a specific tower site versus a broad geographic area play into this? Why does that distinction matter?
It matters hugely because NEPA review and also related reviews under the National Historic Preservation Act, NHPA, are only triggered if the agency action is considered a major federal action. The FCC is questioning whether issuing certain types of licenses should be considered MFAs.
For example,
a site-based license clearly authorizes construction at a specific spot, like a new broadcast tower. That seems more like a traditional MFA. But geographic area licenses, common for wireless services, grant rights to use spectrum over a large region, often without the FCC approving individual cell site locations within that area. The FCC is asking if issuing such a broad license without specific site approval should still automatically trigger a full NEPA review.
And what about tower registration?
They're also questioning their antenna structure registration, ASR, rules. Mm. These require registration for certain towers, mainly for FAA notification regarding air safety. The FCC is asking if processing these registrations is non-discretionary, meaning they don't have much choice but to register if criteria are met, and if so, maybe they shouldn't be subject to NEPA review either.
It sounds like they're exploring ways to significantly narrow the scope of projects needing detailed environmental review. What about things like voluntary registrations or emergencies?
Yeah, they're looking at those too. Should the process for towers registered voluntarily, not legally required, be formalized and maybe excluded from needing FAA hazard determinations? They also want to build procedures for emergency actions into their NEPA rules, which they currently lack, to allow faster rebuilding after disasters, for instance. The proposal also touches on the changing ownership landscape. Many towers are owned by separate tower companies now, not the wireless carriers themselves, and who holds the environmental compliance responsibility. And finally, they're reviewing the timeframes for completing environmental assessments, EAs, and environmental impact statements, EISs, to align with new, faster statutory deadlines set by Congress, 1 year for EAs, 2 years for EISs.
The big picture for you, the listener. This is about the fundamental process for how critical infrastructure like wireless networks gets built. Streamlining could definitely speed up broadband deployment, which many want, but it absolutely raises questions about whether environmental and historical preservation reviews might become less thorough. It's a major debate about speed versus oversight. Okay, our last proposed rule takes us into the water. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, is proposing to authorize the incidental take of marine mammals, specifically seals and sea lions, related to a huge infrastructure project, the Interstate Bridge Replacement on I-5. What does incidental take mean here?
Incidental take basically means unintentional harm or harassment to protected marine mammals that occurs during otherwise lawful activities, in this case, bridge construction. It's broken down into level A harassment, which involves potential injury, and level B harassment, which is behavioral disturbance.
And NOAA is proposing to allow this.
Yes. They're proposing to issue incidental harassment authorizations, or IHAs, covering the first 5 years of this massive project, starting around September 2027. The project itself is replacing the I-5 bridges over the Columbia River and North Portland Harbor between Oregon and Washington. They're seismically unsafe and can't handle the traffic demand, so the construction is necessary, and the take authorization is about managing the unavoidable impacts on marine life during that construction. NOAA emphasizes they do not anticipate authorizing any serious injury or death.
Okay, so what kind of bridge work specifically might cause this harassment? What are the noisy activities?
The main culprits are in-water construction activities that generate underwater noise. This includes vibratory pile driving, impact pile driving using big hammers, and also rotary drilling for foundations. They'll also be installing temporary structures like sheet pile cofferdams to create dry work areas and large steel casings for drilled shafts. Plus, bringing in materials by barge requires installing temporary mooring piles. All of this creates noise that travels underwater and can disturb seals and sea lions.
They must have estimated how many animals might be affected and have plans to minimize harm, right?
Absolutely. The proposal identifies the species likely affected harbor seals, California sea lions, and Steller sea lions, and there are extensive mitigation measures required. Key among them is using trained protected species observers, or PSOs.
What do the PSOs do?
They constantly monitor designated zones around the construction activities. If a marine mammal enters a shutdown zone, specific distances calculated for potential level A or level B harassment, which vary depending on the activity and can range from tens to thousands of meters, the construction activity, like pile driving, must be delayed or stopped immediately.
Until the animal leaves.
Until the animal is seen leaving the zone, or until a certain amount of time passes with no resighting, usually 15 minutes. There are also detailed monitoring requirements, like recording acoustic data underwater, counting hammer strikes, noting PSO locations, weather conditions, and documenting all marine mammal sightings and any mitigation actions taken. It's a very structured approach to minimize impact.
So for you listening, this highlights that constant tension. We need to replace critical infrastructure like this major bridge for safety and commerce, but we also have legal obligations to protect marine life. This proposed rule shows the detailed scientific analysis and the mitigation strategies required to try and strike that balance during a huge multi-year construction project. It also shows how these big projects move forward in regulated phases.
A snapshot of ongoing federal activities.
All right, let's move into the notices section of the Register. These are generally announcements, requests for comments, meeting schedules, updates on investigations, a real snapshot of ongoing federal business. First up, the Agricultural Marketing Service, AMS grain inspection fees, and a program termination.
Yeah, two things from AMS. First, the routine annual update. They're announcing the 2025-2026 rates for official grain inspection and weighing services under the U.S. Grain Standards Act, just adjusting fees based on costs.
And the termination.
More significantly, AMS says it intends to terminate its Master Scale program. This program provides scale testing and certification, mostly for railroad track scales used for weighing bulk commodities. The reason? They say fee collections haven't been enough to cover the program's costs, so they're proposing to shut it down and look into transferring the depot to another agency, or maybe even a private entity. They note the Grain Standards Act doesn't actually mandate testing for scales used for non-grain commodities.
Okay. Switching to the Department of Commerce, there are several trade-related notices here. What's going on with, say, temporary steel fencing from China?
Okay, trade stuff. For that steel fencing from China, the International Trade Administration, or ITA, has made a preliminary finding that, yes, is being sold in the U.S. at less than fair value, basically dumped. This covers specific types of fencing panels. The final decision on whether to impose duties has been postponed, though, giving them more time.
And what about monomers and oligomers from Korea?
Similar process, different product. That's another investigation into potential dumping, selling below fair value. For this one, the ITA is simply postponed, making its preliminary determination, likely due to complexity or maybe a request from the petitioner. They now have up to 190 days from when the case started.
And there's something about oil country tubular goods, OCTG, from China and Thailand?
Yes, this one's about circumvention. The ITA made a preliminary finding that seamless OCTG pipes used in oil and gas drilling that are finished in Thailand using steel billets originally from China are essentially getting around existing anti-dumping and countervailing duty orders already in place on Chinese OCTG.
So they're saying the work done in Thailand isn't enough to change the origin?
Pretty much. As a result, these Thai finished goods using Chinese billets will now likely be included under the scope of the original orders on China, meaning importers might face duties unless they can certify the origin isn't Chinese.
Okay. And also from Commerce, specifically the Bureau of Industry and Security, BIS, there's a notice about an upcoming meeting.
Right. BIS's Transportation and Related Equipment Technical Advisory Committee, or TransTAC, is holding a meeting on September 10th. This committee advises on export control policies for things related to transportation. Part of the meeting will be closed to the public, likely to discuss confidential trade secrets or government strategies related to export controls.
So for you listening, these notices show the constant churn in international trade regulation investigations into fair pricing, efforts to prevent companies from dodging existing duties, and ongoing policy discussions about controlling exports of sensitive technologies. It impacts everything from farm goods to industrial materials. Okay, moving to infrastructure and energy. The Federal Transit Administration, FTA, has proposed new guidance for its big grant program.
Yes, for the Capital Investment Grants Program, or CIG. This is a major source of funding for large public transit projects like new rail lines or bus rapid transit. FTA is proposing updates to its policy guidance for evaluating projects seeking these grants.
What's driving the updates?
The notice mentions recent executive orders from early 2025 related to things like unleashing American energy and ending certain diversity, equity, and inclusion programs.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, they're proposing to revert to a previous method for evaluating the environmental benefits criterion for CIG projects. They're asking for public comments on these proposed changes.
Interesting. Now, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, seems busy too, with several notices about hydro projects and energy infrastructure. What's on their plate?
Quite a bit. First, there's an application from Longmont Energy in Texas for a proposed pumped storage hydroelectric project. This is a big one.
Pumped storage?
Yeah, where they pump water uphill to a reservoir when electricity is cheap, then release it downhill through turbines to generate power when demand is high. This proposal involves building a new 40-acre upper reservoir behind a large earthen dam, multiple tunnels, penstocks, a powerhouse with 6 large pump turbines, and a new transmission line. It's projected to generate a lot of electricity annually.
And FERC's take?
They've issued a notice saying they've accepted the application for filing and will hold a public meeting. Interestingly, FERC staff preliminarily concluded that approving this major project would not constitute a major federal action significantly affecting the quality of the human environment, suggesting maybe a less intensive environments review might follow.
Okay, what else from FERC?
There's a notice regarding PacifiCorp projects in Utah. FERC is basically putting the Utah Department of Environmental Quality on the clock. PacifiCorp needs state water quality certifications under the Clean Water Act for 2 projects, and FERC is reminding the state they have 1 year from the request date to act. Otherwise, the certification is considered waived under federal law. It highlights the interplay between federal and state permitting.
And hydro license is expiring.
Yes. 2 notices related to projects in New York. The license for the Columbia Water Supply hydroelectric project is expiring soon, but FERC notes it will automatically renew annually until they issue a new long-term license. Similarly, the town of Wells can continue operating the Lake Algonquin Hydro Project under its old license terms while this relicensing process is ongoing. This shows the continuity needed to keep these facilities operating during lengthy regulatory reviews.
So for you listening, these notices show federal agencies actively shaping transit funding priorities based on current administration policies, evaluating major new energy projects like pumped storage, and managing the complex long-term licensing of existing hydropower facilities. These actions impact local communities, energy grids, and the environment. Okay, beyond infrastructure, agencies are tackling health, safety, and other broad issues. Health and Human Services, HHS, has a notice about the opioid crisis in rural areas.
Yes, the Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA, within HHS, is seeking OMB approval for new performance measures for its Rural Communities Opioid Response Program, or RCRRP Impact Program.
Performance measures.
Meaning, they want to track specific outcomes to see how well the program is doing. The goal of ARCADE-RP is to improve access to integrated treatment and recovery services for substance use disorder, including opioid use disorder, specifically in rural communities which are often underserved. This notice shows the ongoing effort to combat the opioid crisis with measurable results.
And the EPA is active again, with several notices about new chemicals and pesticides. What's the flow there?
It shows their constant oversight role. First, they're announcing they've received applications to register new pesticide products containing active ingredients not currently on the market. They're asking for public comment on these new potential pesticides.
And chemicals under TSCA.
Right. Under the Toxic Substances Control Act, they regularly publish notices about new chemical submissions they've received. This includes PMNs, pre-manufacture notices for brand new chemicals, SNUNs, significant new use notices for new ways to use existing chemicals, and MCANs for new microorganisms. Today's notice lists several examples like polymers and complex salts, just showing the variety of new substances entering commerce that EPA reviews.
And they also finalize cancellations sometimes.
Yes. There's also a notice issuing a final order for the voluntary cancellation of certain pesticide registrations. This happens when the company that makes the pesticide asks to cancel it. EPA publishes the request, and if no substantive objections are raised, the cancellation becomes effective, as it did today for these specific products.
Okay, finally, a quick rundown of a few other notable notices showing the breadth of federal activity. What about Homeland Security, State Department, SEC?
Okay, quick hits. DHS FEMA. As we mentioned, a major disaster declaration for Puerto Rico due to Tropical Storm Ernesto, triggering federal aid. Also, CISA within DHS is updating how states report on their emergency communication capabilities, the SCIP process, for funding purposes. Department of State. They've announced the statutory debarment of several individuals convicted of violating arms export control laws, meaning these people are banned from participating in defense trade. They also extended an information collection related to payments under the Havana Act for eligible individuals experiencing health incidents. International Trade Commission, ITC. They terminated Bass Pro from an investigation into rechargeable batteries after a settlement was reached with the complainant, Lithium Hub, who had alleged patent infringement. Case closed for Bass Pro, Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC. Several proposed rule changes from stock exchanges are up for review. Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC. CBO BZX wants to create a lower fee category for limited underwriter members to attract more brokers. Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC.
CBO BZX also proposes to list and trade shares of the Grayscale Solana Trust, a spot Solana SOL exchange-traded product, ETP. This is a big one. Framed as providing regulated access to SOL. The notice digs into Solana's tech, security for the trust's assets, like cold storage, multi-sig wallets, and importantly argues why SOL might be resistant to manipulation, citing market depth and arbitrage. It also debates the security versus commodity issue for crypto assets. Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC. NASDAQ proposes a new optional data product called the All Cancels Report to help firms analyze why their orders get canceled. Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC. NASDAQ also wants to adjust pricing thresholds and rebates for market makers trading certain options, non-penny symbols on the NOM market.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot happening.
So for you, the listener, these notices are a whirlwind tour. Disaster response, emergency communications planning, managing pesticides and chemicals, enforcing export controls, resolving trade disputes, and the constant evolution of financial markets, including the ongoing integration of crypto assets like Solana into regulated exchanges. It really shows the vast scope of federal government activity on any given day. Outro. Wow. Okay. What a journey through just one single day of the Federal Register. It really covers the map, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. From big picture things like trying to secure our pharmaceutical supply chain and reaffirming Social Security.
To the nitty gritty of, you know, terminating an airline hotline rule because Congress changed the law or making it easier for actuaries to do their continuing education online.
And tackling those relentless robocalls with new tech guardrails. Proposing shifts in how meat inspection works, ensuring helicopter safety.
Streamlining tax reporting for partnerships, approving state plans for cleaner air in national parks, rethinking environmental reviews for broadband.
Managing the impact of bridge construction on seals, adjusting grain inspection fees, investigating trade practices, licensing energy projects, funding opioid response programs.
And even paving the way for new ways to invest in cryptocurrencies like Solana on major exchanges. It's just everywhere.
It really is. And what strikes me is how interconnected it all feels, even when the topics seem so different. You see these threads running through shifts in economic policy, adapting to new technology, balancing safety and efficiency, environmental concerns.
It's this constant effort to adjust how the government interacts with, well, everyone. Industries, citizens, the environment.
A continuous process of refinement, yeah.
So what does this all mean for you listening? I think it's just a powerful reminder that the rules shaping your world are constantly being written and rewritten, often in these dense documents, not just in the big headlines.
And getting a peek behind that curtain, understanding the why behind a change, even a small one, can be really valuable.
It helps you connect the dots.
Exactly. Which leads me to a final thought, maybe a question for you, our listener. We covered so much today, from proposed rules that might become law to final actions. Given that huge range, what's one area you heard about today? Maybe a proposed rule, maybe an ongoing issue reflected in a notice that you think deserves even more public attention and scrutiny as it moves forward.
That's a great question. Where should we collectively be digging deeper? Something to think about. We really hope this deep dive gave you a useful shortcut to understanding what happened in the Federal Register on this particular Tuesday, August 19th, 2025. Maybe it sparked some curiosity about this often overlooked but incredibly impactful part of how our country runs.
Hope so.
Until next time, keep digging.